Bob's Red Mill. Believes in baking, breakfast, and the pursuit of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Today's episode 81 of Feast Your Ears, and I'd like to welcome Tim Harney into the studio today.
Hello.
Tim is an industrial designer turned motorcycle builder who makes custom bikes in Bushwick and is also co-owner of Moto Spirits, a rice whiskey and distillery and distiller of other things that shares his shop. Thanks, Tim, for coming out to the studio today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I have to say, every time I hear that ad before my show for the fun drive, I kind of think I should change out my music to be a little funkier. I feel like, I mean, I like the music. The music before my show is written by my brother,
really,
but every time I hear it, I'm like, ooh, maybe this could be my pre-show music.
You need sexier food music.
Yeah. Feast your sexy ears,
feast
maybe.
Feast your ears.
So Tim, you know, when you meet somebody, and inevitably the conversation wanders around to, or maybe immediately, hey, what do you do? How do you describe yourself?
Yeah, that's a tough one lately. I kind of wear a lot of hats. I do have to correct you. I'm just a partner in that distillery. I'm not a co-owner.
I see.
It's hard to exist in New York City without a bunch of different slashes behind your title. So I guess I'm a motorcycle builder / distillery guy / fill in the blank. Tomorrow is always a different description. I don't know. I think the easy one is just like, yeah, I build custom bikes.
Yeah, right. That's one that people can wrap their brain around and they have some idea.
Yeah.
At least they can, like, in their brain, they can close their eyes and they see you
and a
motorcycle.
Yeah. Saying industrial designer is just like, no one has any idea what you're talking about. It's just like, you could be like architect, be like, oh, buildings. Okay. Interior designer, inside stuff. Industrial designer, like, you design shoes or agricultural products. Yeah.
So what led you into studying design and then subsequently into making motorcycles?
So I had a bit of a like a pageant mom and dad.
Right.
So they were always kind of harping on I need to be an architect, or I need to be some sort of a designer. I've always been kind of like some tweaker meth head. I've been like disassembling and taking things apart as long as I can remember.
Question, though, I mean, as someone who grew up taking lots of things apart, I can identify a real point in time where the putting things back together became part of the project, not just the taking it apart. Can you identify that as well?
Yeah. Oh, I have to preface that Harry and I are both BMW 2002 people.
Yes.
This is a brotherhood that
I'm not a motorcycle guy. I'm a car guy. So,
yeah, that well, I mean, that's I am also a car guy, but. I guess that's neither here nor there. What was your question again? I'm sorry.
You're talking about being, you know, growing up being like a tinkerer, right?
Yeah.
And taking things apart.
Yeah.
For me, I also used to love taking things apart because I wanted to see what was in things.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course.
You know, you have like a stereo receiver on your shelf and it's like a box with some knobs and it's like, wait, what's in there?
Yeah.
And so you take it apart. It took me a long time. I mean, well into my teens before I started then understanding the things and putting them back together. So there was lots of disassembly early on. I think when I was like 10, a friend and I disassembled a Volkswagen Beetle that was in the woods behind his house. We certainly did not put it back together. I mean, there was broken glass. And
is it still sitting in the woods?
I have no idea. I don't even... That particular friend, maybe I shouldn't even mention his name. I don't even know. He got in trouble in high school for hacking in the early 90s and like you know, like... Got sued and jail time.
Yeah, well, let's not mention his name then.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't know where
the Voldemort of friends.
Yeah.
I think it's really important that everybody do some self-discovery. Taking things apart. I mean, if you're like even remotely curious about how things, you know, work in this world, then I mean you shouldn't wait for somebody to teach you how to do something. I mean, like, the best lessons are the lessons, you know, learned like in the moment. I mean, I don't know. I learned what electricity was from my dad, who sarcastically was like, yes, I asked, what were those things on the wall? And he was like, why don't you stick your finger in it?
Yeah.
So
I mean, we had a parallel life. So my dad collected and still owns a number of antique fire engines. When I was a kid, he had a Magneto out of a 1920s fire engine with a hand crank on it in the basement. And he was like, here, put your fingers here.
Yeah.
And turn the crank and you get zapped, you know, with, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not enough to, like,
you know what? It's funny. It's funny you say that about a Magneto. I literally just did that on, this old Harley I have, runs also off of a Magneto. For those that don't know, a Magneto is essentially a means of charging these old engines and creating a lot of spark from a small amount of rotation. So a little device, it's like a capacitor or a battery. And if you're holding the wrong end of it, it will give you a nasty, nasty little shock. And I was holding my Magneto the other day and by accident spun it in my hand, and it's like 40,000 volts or something through your hand instantly. And it just like made my right arm go numb for the rest of the day. It's lovely, lovely experience. But,
But you're here to tell about it,
yeah,
right?
I think
that, you know, there are dangers, right? I mean, people talk about like sticking forks and outlets and things like that. And there are a lot of safety things around to prevent you from dying doing those things. And
yeah, but I mean, that baptism by fire on like, you know, those lessons that will, you'll never forget that.
Yep.
I guarantee you've never touched that Magneto again.
Nope.
When you probably are slightly scared of, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, a little bit of fear installed in learning is just as important as the thing that you're learning itself.
Those are the things that you learn and help you remember later, right? Like,
right.
I had to replace the starter on my van a couple weeks ago, and I will never, ever forget to take the negative cable off the battery.
Oh, no.
Ever when I'm doing that stuff, you know, like, because of that. I mean, yep. I have a great amount of respect for electricity and understanding that I don't want it going through me.
Doesn't matter if you respect it or not. It will make you respect it.
Yeah.
But, totally. I think those, kind of learning in the moment, it's like, you know, if you want to learn a language, it's the best thing to do is immerse yourself in the like culture or whatever,
yep.
You know? So this is, so I say, like, just start taking stuff apart if you're even mildly curious about it.
Yeah. So you started taking stuff apart and eventually putting it back together.
Yes. Yes. I was more fascinated about, like mechanical kind of components more than electrical. I mean, I do electrical stuff on a daily basis now, but I mean that came by default. But it was mainly like I don't know, bicycles and things like that, and like car parts and anything that was mechanical and like gear driven. Like, you know, I had a drill press that unfortunately didn't make it through the transition, as I call it, because I was like, I'll make it more powerful.
Right.
I need this drill press to spin even faster, which in point of fact is not what you want.
Yep.
So I had this like, what is it? This drawer when I was growing up called my innovation drawer, which is ridiculous. And it was just full of these carcasses of these once like successful products. I think it was like my go-to was like Craftsman. Because I could just replace it.
Oh, yes. Sears used to give you any, you know,
return it broken,
get a new one.
Yeah, exactly. So I was just like, well, that makes sense to me. And apparently if you bring pieces of your drill, like, obviously taken apart, they will not accept that. Lesson learned. Yeah.
And now you'd be hard-pressed to find a Sears that was even open to go in and take
it. You know what? Craftsman sort of does that. It's like they, for those that don't know, Craftsman is like a, you know, like an everything kind of brand, and they have a lifetime guarantee on all their stuff, but depends on what you do with it. Like if you see that, like they, you heated it up and bent it, they'll be like, obviously you messed this up. So I'm not, you don't get another one.
Yeah. Yeah. And so your tinkering with mechanical items led you to study how they were designed and and built, right?
Yeah. I mean, so for those that don't know, industrial design is kind of the all-encompassing design world. It's I'd say it's like 40% aesthetics and then 60% how, like, why you're designing that. Or at least that's, as I see it, is the good industrial designers out there. Because there's a lot of industrial designers that will just draw a pretty, like, a pretty picture, and then they'll just send it off to some engineer in Guangzhou, China, to figure out the rest. But, yeah, like, in theory, you're trying to, you know, better an existing product or better an existing idea. You know, there's a million chairs out in the world, so why on earth would your chair that you're designing today be any better than the next? So, and that's what an industrial designer does. You're perpetually trying to find the betterment of fill in the blank, you know? So
are your motorcycles better than the next guys?
Oh man. I would never say that my motorcycles are better than anything. They're just different. I mean, the clients that I have, which are, you know, I'm thrilled that, you know, the client base that I have, are mainly creatives. So like a lot of the things that, initially attract people to my motorcycles, I think are that they're very shiny. But the thing that's really important to me is that they work really well. And in point of fact, they work better than they used to work. So like, you know, my go-to, or rather my wheelhouse for motorcycles are typically like BMWs, Airheads specifically, air-cooled motors. It's kind of modeled off like an airplane engine for those that don't know. And it's, they're kind of like this, anemic form of combustion, and they just need a lot of stuff for them to kind of flourish and come into their own, you know, better exhaust system, better, carburetor system. You do some head work, and then you create a like if you're creating a dish, you gather your ingredients, and in the right metered amount, you know, hopefully you get a good steak at the end.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that's how you're creating your bike. So you're not milling it. You're not building engines. You're not milling every single piece, but you're assembling some.
No, I mean, I do some of that.
Massaging them, right?
I'm not sitting there making, like, you know, from a block of aluminum, making an engine block and things like that. But, you know, I know that I just don't know how to do that properly. Like I could, but I don't.
Right.
Yeah, that and the like monetary value of creating in it. Like there's nobody paying, like you're like, paying for like me to sit there and be like, hey, this engine's made from solid, you know, titanium. And I'd be like, great,
by hand,
that's, yeah. I'd be like, cool. Like it's a $500,000 engine. Yeah. Like, yeah, that's a motorcycle that's not selling.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I make motorcycles. I like to create around a price, so it's a little bit more realistic. It's realistic as a manufacturer of these things, but it's also realistic. Consumers just don't want to pay, you know, $100,000-$200,000 for a bike. It's just like it's just not there.
Right.
Like nobody can wrap their head around that.
Yeah.
Or at least nobody that I know.
Right. Not yet. If anybody's
out there
who wants to spend $200,000 on a motorcycle.
Anybody out there who wants a $500,000 bike,
Tim can
I can
make
do
it.
That for you.
Yeah, no problem.
Yes, no problem.
I want to go back to what you said though about just taking these things apart and learning about it. I think that that is something that obviously you and I have, you know, share that as a common thread of, you know, I am far more willing. There are lots of things I don't know how to do, lots of things I can't do, but there's almost nothing that I'm afraid not to try, because I also know that by and large I can find someone who can help me do it or can fix it if I really, really screw it up.
You know, that's a really rare thing.
I know. It's too bad.
There's like the majority of the population in the world that is A, either just not interested, or B, just not ambitious enough to actually even want to take that on.
Well, and I think that part of it too is that you know, the more we live in a world where, you know, and I think there's an interesting corollary here between food and working on mechanical things, cars,
sure,
in my case, and cars, yeah, and motorcycles, yeah, in your case, yeah, where, you know, I decided to try to make my own hard cider by shredding apples in a food processor and then squeezing them. Because I wanted to try, because,
yeah,
I wanted to,
yeah,
know,
yeah,
the,
yeah,
process from start to finish. It's the same, yeah, reason that, like, I will replace, you know, the first time I replaced a, you know, clutch slave cylinder or did the brakes myself, yeah, because I was like, well, I'm going to assemble all the parts for this and I'm going to read a lot about it,
yeah,
and I'm going to maybe ask some people and then I'm going to try and do it. And I'm either going to succeed or I'm going to fail.
Yeah.
But either way, I'm going to learn a lot. And if I fail, it's not, nothing terrible is going to happen. I'm just going to have someone else do the brakes or not drink the cider, right?
Like, yeah, yeah, not drink the cider. I'm going to use that. That's a good metaphor. Don't drink the cider. Yeah, yeah, I think there's a lot of people that have just kind of grown complacent with what's given to them, what's, yeah, you know, right in front of them. Yeah. And if it's if it doesn't make sense within the first, like, what's within 5 feet in front of you, then it's just like, you know, it's like, this isn't my wheelhouse. So, like, you know. You look at your cell phone and it's got a broken screen. A lot of people are just like, well, now what? Now what, right, do I do? And you're just like, my world just is shattered, literally. Yeah. And you're just like, well, you could be resourceful and maybe go on YouTube and, you know,
find
figure
700
out,
videos, yeah, of, yeah, how to replace,
like,
it.
Yeah. Or you could just, you know, do like the rest of us do and just drop it off at, you know, your local, whatever, iPhone store, sure, to fix your screen. It's that DIY kind of culture is, I'd like to say that it's, you know, that it's strong and doing well, but I just feel like there's so many people that are becoming complacent just because of, like, I don't know, consumer electronics have ruined us.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, consumer electronics are moving so quick right now that by the time, you know, you get your iPhone 7, there's probably going to be an iPhone 8 out there within the next, like, 6 months. So,
right,
you're, you know, your new technology is already dated within 6 months. I mean,
yeah,
yeah, it's difficult to keep on building on, you know, these ideas of, like, do it yourself, yeah, when like consumer electronics and things like that are just kind of ruining this hope.
I do think, though, that there are some signs of hope out there for this. I mean, I think food is one. I would like to think, at least, you know, in the world that I exist in, having just written a book about how to make vinegar, that hopefully people will be encouraged to do this at home and to learn about it,
yeah,
and to experiment with it. And it's not, you know, in the antique truck collecting world, my dad also collected or had a 1931 Chevy two-door, oof, coupe.
Oh,
and there used to be, years and years ago, I don't know if it still exists, but there was, I think it was the American Antique Chevrolet, like, mm-hmm, group,
yeah,
association, had a monthly or quarterly magazine called Generator and Distributor. And and in,
awesome,
in that magazine, there was a column called The Junkyard Dogs. And it was guys who went out. And I remember reading, I would read this, you know, in the 80s when it would come, I'd read it,
yeah,
and it was clearly taken on 35 millimeter film, photographs of, like, yeah, finding these old junkyards in the woods. And,
yeah,
one of them had a, you know, Model A stuck in a tree because the tree had grown up and lifted the thing off the ground. And,
oh, that's so cool.
And their motto was, the fun is in the search, right?
Yeah.
They were always looking for specific parts. Guys looking for a door handle for a 32 Chevy truck or whatever. And he's, mm-hmm, out there and they're scouring. And the whole point was that, you know, the journey was the point.
Yeah.
If you found the thing, that's great. And I think that is becoming, I would like to believe, more true in things like cooking. And then I see another, you know, I also, aside from owning a BMW 2002, I own a Volkswagen Vanagon.
Oh, and so cool.
The van life hashtag has, like,
yeah,
blown up in the past couple of
it
years.
Has,
I mean, I've had my van for, like, more than
vans.
10 years.
Yeah.
There's a lot of vans around,
yeah,
and there's this idea of people getting on the road, and it's very shiny and Instagrammy. I have a friend who's like, well, it's just porn.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah,
porn without boobs, or sometimes there are boobs. Like, you know, it's like,
there's,
you know,
all sorts of kinds of porn nowadays.
Yeah.
I've realized, you know, I subscribe to, like, a handful of Instagram pages that are just, like, different engines.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm sitting there drooling and trying to figure out how these work.
Right.
But,
But I think that the van life thing, you know, we're talking about, I mean, you know, they're not all Volkswagen vans. Some people are, you know, in newer vans and Sprinters and,
yeah,
things like that. And they're out living on the road. But part of the thing that is, I think, starting to crack the surface a little bit is that it's not all these beautiful photos, right? It's, oh, here I am. I'm broken down. and it's my van won't start, and like
that's a true Volkswagen.
Does anybody out there like can anyone help me? And so what you see in some of these is you see comment threads where people are saying, well, you should check this and you should check this. So there's like a community around helping these people figure this out, and they kind of need to, and you kind of have to be willing to do that if you're gonna.
Well, I mean, it's funny that you talk about these barn finds is just because I have this theory. I call it the flea market theory, which is it's not really what you're buying at the flea market. It's actually the search for, and it's like you're reliving that memory that you had. It's just basically like this like dopamine kind of fix that you're having. You're like, oh my God, I can't even believe it. It's like a Hot Wheel track from, you know, the 80s, or this was a Transformer. Sorry, I'm using toys as references, but it's usually the best because you're going to this like adolescent memory of you having like fill in the blank. Food has those triggers as well. Yeah. If you have like, you know, like I didn't realize until recently that I had these really solid food triggers. I went home to my parents' house and I had this like, my mom always used to make this like lasagna, something rather another dish. It wasn't lasagna, but it was like something else. I honestly can't recall the specifics of what it was, but it was this this taste trigger that I had, and I just remember having it. I was like, oh my God. And it was like a flood of memories based on this one bite. And I was like, oh my God, I can't remember. Like, I can't believe that you made this. She's like, yeah, you remembered. I'm like, oh my God, yes, of course. I was like, it was. And then I also remembered, I was like, oh man, she used to make this way too much. Like, and it was just like,
so it was nice to come back after many years.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I was like, that was a perfect amount of time. That like 20 years of not having that. And then I remember being like, she's like, you want seconds? I was like, you know what? I'm good. I'm good.
Right, right. You got the memories. It worked.
Yeah, I got the memories out of this thing. So no more lasagna thing.
Cool. We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors here at Heritage Radio. And when we come back, I want to hear about a story that you alluded to about eating grass.
Absolutely.
I'm Mike Colomeco, host of Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm here with Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill, as well as Ray and Tom Williams, who've worked with Bob for years and co-own an organic farm in eastern Oregon and Washington. Ray, Tom, why is organic farming so important to your family?
It's all a matter of the soil as a source of nutrients. You increase organic matter of the soil, you increase the water holding capacity. Water is becoming increasingly scarce. So in terms of sustainability, we don't think it's the only answer, but it's one answer, and it's the answer that we're trying to pursue.
It's been a challenge, and it's been fun because it is different, and we're learning how to do it for the last 10 plus years.
We're not just doing organic, we're doing organic to high standards.
Bob, why did you choose to partner with Ray and Tom?
Oh, goodness. Well, because they're the best farmers in Oregon, and they're close, and they have a bunch of acres, I think about 10,000, over in eastern Oregon and Washington. They're wonderful farmers, and their family have been farmers over there for many, many years.
It's really important that you have long-term relationships, and we've enjoyed a long-term relationship with Bob's because there are a lot of challenges to organic farming. You simply don't have as many tools as a conventional farmer, and so you have to rely on longer-term solutions.
Knowing that you have a market is absolutely critical. The margins in farming are not that great, so if you grow the stuff and you can't sell it, you have a real problem. And we know with Bob's that we have a market, and we turn out high-quality grains, and they buy them, and it all works well.
Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and if you're just joining us, I have Tim Harney of Tim Harney Motorcycles here in the studio. Before the break, we were talking about and imploring you, the listeners, to get out there and just try your hand at things, because you can't really screw it up that badly, right? Like, if you like, you should just make cassoulet if you decide that that's of interest to you, or you should just like take your car apart if you want to know how it works.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me about eating grass, Tim.
I can tell you it's probably not advisable at this point in my life without somebody, maybe sending me to a hospital. But, yeah, so when I was a little kid, I did, I think what maybe a lot of like, younger kids did. I have an older brother and an older sister, and I saw my brother, without any backstory, I saw my brother outside eating grass. The story was, is that he, wasn't eating his breakfast, and, in anger towards my parents, he thought that the great idea would be to go outside and start eating grass,
As an act of defiance.
Yeah. Just show them like, I don't need your food.
Right. Which I have this whole lawn.
Yeah. 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 Like, I don't need you guys. I'm good. I can go. I'm feral now. And I'm going to,
how old was he?
I don't know. Maybe like 10.
Nice. To look forward to with my son.
Yeah, the eating grass thing is, I don't know. I mean, but it was like a lot of grass. Anyway, so I came downstairs not hearing this conversation, this argument they were having, and I saw, you know, my brother, who I like idolized, eating grass outside, and I was like, oh, well, I guess that's the green light on grass then. So I took it upon myself. I even remember sitting out there, and I was like, trying, and I was like, this doesn't taste great, but I mean, he's doing it. So this is what I'm doing now. And just the massive amount of grass that it took for me to just realize, like, this is so stupid. But
I mean, it's a good thing that you weren't eating, you know, like there weren't mushrooms growing on the lawn, or, you know, yeah, what I mean? Like, that's something that could have really hurt you.
It was not
you,
a wise idea. Yeah. I don't care. I mean, like, you know, to all kids out there, I mean, nowadays, I'm sure, like, you know, kids are getting like gluten-free, non-processed, natural, you know, free-range fill-in-the-blank. And I mean, in all honesty, I think some kids probably need to eat a little bit of grass.
Sure.
But yeah, it builds up your immunity. It builds character or exactly. Backbone or whatever. Fill-in-the-blank. Some, I don't know. Maybe it was a bad idea. Who knows? But yeah, my grass-eating story is to this day. It's funny. I was just telling Harry for a second was that... I'm speaking like I'm speaking to a crowd here. I still to this day try to emulate what my brother and sister are doing. I mean, I'd say that they're a wiser folk than myself. So I get a phone call from my brother saying, you got to eat at this restaurant. And I immediately am like, okay, I'll be eating at that restaurant. It's the grass. The proverbial grass is still not eaten, apparently.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to read a couple paragraphs from a book that I'm in the middle of currently called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human by Richard Wrangham. It's an interesting book. It talks about how and sort of hypothesizes that really the thing that allowed us to evolve into the human form that we have now is that we were able to have fire and cook our food, which made a lot more nutrients sort of bioavailable to us rather than eating things that are raw.
Have you ever watched the movie Quest for Fire?
Yeah. A long time ago.
It is. That sums up me.
Yeah. So I'm going to read two paragraphs just because I think it's related to this, because I'm curious to know, Tim, after I read this, if you know, if you would follow your siblings into this kind of eating.
Yeah.
So instinctotherapists, which are a minority group among raw foodists, believe that because we are closely related to apes, we should model our eating behavior on theirs. In 2003, I had lunch with Roman DeVivo and Aunt Jay Spores, whose book Genefit Nutrition argues that cooked food provides an unhealthy diet to which we are not adapted. They were lean and healthy. They were clear about their preference, which was to eat all their food not merely raw, but without any preparation at all. They politely declined a salad because its ingredients had been chopped and mixed. The natural way, they explained, is to do what chimpanzees do. Just as those apes find only one kind of fruit when eating in a given tree, so we should eat only one kind of food in any meal. To illustrate their habit, DeVivo, Spores, and a friend had brought a basket containing a selection of organic foods. They sniffed at several fruits, one at a time, to allow their bodies to decide what would suit them best, by instinct, they said. One chose apples, another chose a pineapple. Each ate only his or her first choice. The third decided on a protein-rich food. He had brought frozen buffalo steaks and pieces of buffalo femur. Today was a marrow day. The femur chunks were the size of golf balls. Inside of each was a cold pink mush that looked like strawberry ice cream. He cleaned out several pieces of bone with a teaspoon.
Mmm.
Doesn't sound particularly pleasant. And to be honest, I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not a nutritionist, but when I think about like what makes a nutritious meal, just spooning bone marrow out of a femur does not.
Yeah,
that sounds like, I mean, I don't feel like I could do that and be like, I'm ready to face the day. Like, you know, let's go, you know, let's go to work.
Starts the day, like, maybe like a Tony Tiger kind of sponsored and just, like eating Tony Tiger's backbone. Like, great. I don't know if I could subscribe to that. I do. I can speak to the regimen of a diet. Once upon a time, when in the healthier versions of myself, in high school, I used to wrestle, and finding a routine is like vital to creating like a standard. So like if, for instance, my diet was really regimented, like I could drop weight and or gain weight really quickly because my metabolism was so kind of acute.
And that would determine what weight, where you
yeah,
wrestled,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. What weight were you wrestling? Yeah. So I'd eat massive amounts of broccoli and totally just, you know, like steamed broccoli and chicken. And it was, I hated the diet. I hated it. But like, if you find some routine in it, and you start eating food for its utilitarian sake and not for pleasure, that's what, you know, a lot of us, you know, kind of get twisted on.
Yeah.
And you know, if you're just eating it, you know, like, listen, I just got to get past this and I don't care what it tastes like. It doesn't matter what it tastes like. You can create some kind of regimen to how you're feeling and how your weight can fluctuate.
Yeah.
I mean, I did that recently. That was sobering. Apparently I don't have a great deal of will anymore for non-pleasure based foods. I'm weak.
Well, but I don't think it has to be so binary though. I mean, I feel like you can be in a situation where, you know, like I don't usually like have a beer for breakfast. I mean, like I like
you don't
beer
usually meaning
a lot.
It sometimes an occasional beer.
I just don't. I don't. You know. I can't remember the last time I had a beer for breakfast. But I mean, like, you know, the other day, some friends happened to be biking by my apartment on like Saturday, and they popped in, and it was like, you know, 11:45 in the morning, and I was like, I don't know, you guys want a beer? Like, and we just had a beer at 11:45. It was like, fine.
You know what? If those friends biked by on a Tuesday morning, I bet you would have a different opinion.
I'm sure you're right.
Saturday-based
beer.
But
it's not binary,
Saturday,
right?
It's like, yeah, when Friday comes, most of Friday's a wash. And then all the way till Monday, it's like it doesn't matter. The rules don't apply. So it's like
wake up and have ice cream and beer.
We're stuck
in this weird cycle, right? Like where we live in this way where like everybody is on that same train to a certain extent, right? Everybody's like, oh, it's Friday night.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, like we're all living in the confines of, you know, social boundaries. So you know, that's why like most people don't wake up and have like a pint of ice cream.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah, besides like you're going to feel awful either about yourself and about, you know, your body is really not going to react well to that. We have people that are around us that are like, ooh, bad idea. Like maybe rethink your life. Just as much as, you know, waking up on a Tuesday morning and having a beer is like, yeah, maybe socially frowned upon. There's probably tons of people out there that are drinking a beer, listening to this program right now and be like, I disagree, but you know, to each his own.
Yeah.
You can see past those social norms, you know, Yahtzee. My hat's off to you.
Tim, you recently got married.
I did.
You know, to a wonderful woman who is also obsessed with,
cars,
machines that go fast.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate for both of us because we are both enablers in each other's vices.
Yeah.
Yeah. We both perpetually feast on speed and control, which is dangerous. in a home.
I mean, I it seems to me like it could also be viewed that you guys are like some kind of like a power couple. I mean, you now have like, you've got really cool cars and really cool bikes and, you know, you know how to fix them. And
that
like,
is,
you know,
one way to look at it. Yeah. That is.
What did you have for food at your wedding?
Oh, yeah. We kind of lucked out. We've got some friends that are very good at making food. We have a friend named Andrew Carmelini, who owns a handful of really successful restaurants.
And I'm sure has been in this studio numerous times on Heritage Radio.
Yeah, Andrew Carmelini owns, you know, he's a Michelin-rated restaurant owner and cook and chef. And he was nice enough. He's owner of Luga. I hope I'm saying the name right. It'd be awful to butcher the name of his restaurant, but in the Williamville Hotel in Williamsburg, and it's not good food, it's great food. It was addictive, and for most people that don't eat on their weddings, which I didn't realize was a thing. I mean, I got to eat a decent portion. I mean, most of it was talking to people, in all honesty, I mean, I've never heard such amazing reviews. You know, we had a small, a small dinner reception just for, you know, like our families and like really good close friends. And then we had a huge party, which was, at a different location where my wife works, but, this place called the Classic Car Club in the city. And then we had about like 150 people there. We figured it was just like a lot more cost effective too. Make a bunch of people really happy about food, and then a whole another bunch of people happy about booze.
Oh, nice!
Yeah,
nice.
Cake and booze.
So, did you serve Moto spirits?
We did. Cool. We did. Went through a lot of whiskey.
So tell me a little bit about about Moto spirits. So, sure. Moto spirits is a distillery that is in the same shop as yours.
Yeah, yeah.
And has two products available. Right. Mm-hmm. There's a rice based whiskey.
Yes. Yes. So it's all rice based. So the story, the kind of the quick story is my Israeli friend Haggai, a very good friend of mine, started this distillery in his bathroom in his building, which I realize does not sound very very good, but. Apparently, a lot of distilleries start this way.
I mean, they call it bathtub gin, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was so when I first saw it, I was like, "Wow, that is an awful thing that you're doing." Can't believe that you're putting that into people's bodies. But now, so he's a motorcycle friend. I've built a handful of motorcycles for him, and that's how we met. He bought a motorcycle for me, and then we kind of hit it off and became friends, And he needed some space for to develop, you know, this recipe, and so we got the space together, and you know, it's it seemingly works. You know, we have like just under about 3,000 square feet in Brooklyn, and that's like a massive amount of space in Brooklyn, and it's a little bit of space for a distillery, right. Apparently, but yeah. We you know, we make it work. He goes on these motorcycle tours. This is the logic on why it's called Moto Spirits. Because the whiskey was discovered on one of these motorcycle tours in Vietnam. Oh, wow. Which is the choice of grain that they distill off of in Vietnam it's the most available.
Sure.
Rice is it's actually difficult to distill off of. It's really temperamental. A matter of like 10 degrees can either make or break your run. So we've learned, and excuse me. We've just been refining it year after year, and now we're legal, and we're in about 34 different places. You know, we became legal as of. Let's see, about 5 months ago, and we're trying to do some kind of grassroots development. We're working with a lot of the local bars and restaurants, and and trying to figure out what the demand is. So far we have two different brands, two different kinds. One is called Jabuka, which is Croatian for apple, which is another kind of whiskey discovered on another motorcycle trip. They're all basically on these discovery. Like my friend Hagai just came back from Greece. He's got some new, you know, recipes that we're gonna hopefully develop and see if they're worth developing or.
Sure.
We're the only distillery in America that sells a rice based grain, which is cool, but it's also the learning curve is far more acute. So we've definitely wasted a lot of rice, like thousands of pounds of rice have just totally wasted trying to figure out this damn formula.
Now, do you guys use koji for the fermentation?
We do. We have a really specific kind of coveted means of creating our starch into sugars. But you know, we use things like, you know, enzymes to get the ball rolling. Everything from like, you know, how we do our we add oxygen to our mash at really specific times. During the fermentation process, we control our fermentation temperatures. So we have jacketed and then cooling, kind of copper cooling in inside of our fermentation tubs, and it's all about refining our mash. Our still is we have this beautiful still that was made for us. It's just a 4-plate column still with a defragulator and a huge condenser, and produces just this beautiful. It pops out at our bodies are about 180 proof.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so I mean that's high. So yeah. So our head is for those that don't know, when you're distilling, you have your head, your body, and your tail. Your tail is usually a far lesser proof, like 60 proof or something like that. And our body, like most stills will, depending on how it's set up, can produce like 140 proof. What that means is you yield more, booze basically. Yeah. So 180 proof. And then we barrel at 180 and then, we bottle at 84 proof, meaning we add distilled water and things like that. So we can control the purity of our product really specifically. And then the exciting thing about what we do is that we have almost relatively zero waste. So we take our mash, our mash becomes soap. We have a soap business that will eventually be out on the market. But I mean, we have soap. I'll give you some soap.
Same branding, Moto Soap.
Yeah, yeah. We have a partner in that because we just don't know how to make soap.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. I'll give you some.
Is it really good at cleaning motorcycle grease off your hands?
I wish. We do have a version of it. We're going to be adding my friend owns a coffee shop, and we're going to be using the coffee grains, spent coffee grains. Yeah. To add
as
like
abrasive.
Pumice. Yeah. Yeah. And it's actually rejuvenates because it's caffeinated.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. So it's awesome. Caffeinated soap.
Caffeinated hands. I can't wait.
Yeah. 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 But I was like, wow, we're getting soap from this. I was like, being a grease monkey, I'm constantly needing pumicey soap, you know, and there's not enough gojo in the world to clean my hands. My hands constantly look like, you know, I'm panhandling, you know, and down on Wall Street or whatever. But, so it's basically we're just trying a bunch of different ways to skin a cat, you know, but
awesome.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And then the other thing that we have, which is even weirder, is we have a license to sell race gas, because when the head of every still is methanol.
Right.
So we sell race gas.
Oh wow.
We haven't sold, you know, any yet, but
yeah,
but we have a license. I mean, it's the
so if
you
so somebody need, do they just email racegas at motospirits.com?
No, we're not, that's our God knows when we're actually going to be selling it, but we have copious amounts of race gas.
Right, you have tons of methanol.
Bizarre. Yeah. But it was like, you know, and when licensing, it was just like one of these things. You're like, you know that you can also do this. And we're like, yeah, we'll take that too.
Yeah, right. Sure. So are you, have you built any bikes specifically to run the,
You know, methanol is really volatile.
Yeah.
And if you, like, if you were to run a car on methanol, your car has to be set up for it.
Yeah.
So a methanol based bike, you'd pretty much blow it up every time you rode it. So it'd have to, that's why they make, like drag bikes are methanol.
Sure.
Yeah, and
so really, I mean, you guys need to somehow forge some kind of an association with like a drag strip in Long Island, State or Jersey or something.
Yeah.
Because
I mean, like,
nobody in Brooklyn's running methanol in anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, that methanol, for those that don't know, would be the equivalent of putting, you know, like you go and you put gas in your car and it's 87, 89, and then 93. So this would be, I think, 140 octane. Something around that line.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, it's clear. And the great thing it would be is your car would spit out this lovely sweet smell.
Yeah.
After it blew itself up.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's cool. We just like, you know, most people just kind of throw away, or they use their heads to like clean and sanitize stuff.
Yep. But you guys have a license to sell it as race.
Yeah, it's race gas.
Great.
Whatever.
Awesome. Well, it's been a real pleasure, Tim. We're pretty
it's
much
been a
out
pleasure.
Of time. I want to make sure people can check out your website. It's timharneymotorcycles.com or motospirits.com.
Yep.
You can follow Tim on social media at Tim Harney Motorcycles. Do you have any events coming up for either your motorcycles or moto that you want to plug while we're here?
Yeah, I mean, we're now doing the Union Square markets.
That's
actually
a great place for people to find you.
Yeah. If you I believe we're doing Wednesdays. We're going to be doing trying to do a regular thing on every Wednesday. We'll be doing free tastings.
So if you're listening right now and you're in the Union Square area, you can go get some Moto Spirits.
Unfortunately, we are not there today.
Okay.
But we will be there on a regular basis.
Great.
And that information will be on our website soon.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to David Tatasciore, who engineers this show every week. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment to like the show on iTunes if you did, in fact, enjoy it. And you can reach me via email with any questions, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com. You can follow me on social media, @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.